to be out of that state of constant tension. Yes, they're still pit bulls. But before that, they're dogs. And dogs aren't supposed to kill one another. So once I block those pit bull genes, the true colors of the dog inside are allowed to surface. The brain is no longer sending pit bull signals. It's sending only dog signals. Breed and aggression. Though there is no such thing as a red zone breed, statistically, pit bulls cause the most bites in the United States, accounting for 41 of the 144 fatalities since 2000, according to the National Canine Research Foundation. Rottweilers ranked second, with 23 attacks. Those numbers are the reason why pit bulls are banned in 200 cities and towns across the United States, including Miami, Cincinnati, and Pawtucket, Rhode Island. In some states, homeowners can't get homeowners insurance or have to pay hefty premiums if they own certain breeds. For instance, Allstate won't insure homes where people own pit bulls, Akitas, Boxers, Chow Chows, Dobermans, Rottweilers, Presa Canarios, or Wolf hybrids. While higher insurance premiums may be one way to encourage more responsible ownership, I believe that the outright banning of breeds is not the answer. Interestingly, the American Kennel Club doesn't even recognize the pit bull per se as an official breed. Branding dog breeds as outlaws is a quick, easy band-aid, but it's not the cure for dog bites or attacks in America. The truth is, any breed of dog can become a red zone case. It's the power of the dog and the physical size of the victim that determines the extent of the damage. Other breeds, too, have killed people. For instance, in 2000, a little Pomeranian mix killed a six-week-old girl in Southern California. In 2005, a Siberian Husky, usually considered a mild-mannered breed, fatally attacked a seven-day-old Rhode Island girl. The owner, most often, is responsible, not the breed and not the dog. By the same token, almost any individual dog may become a good, obedient companion, even though he comes from a breed that is considered naturally aggressive. Remember, aggression is not a natural state. It is the outcome of instability. It's all about the bond and relationship between the dog and his calm, assertive pack leader. Fatal dog attacks, 2000 through early July 2005. Source, National Canine Research Foundation. Pit bull mix, 41. Rottweiler mix, 23. German shepherd mix, 11. Chow mix, 7. Wolf hybrid, 6. Labrador mix, 6. Emily in the Red Zone. One of the most powerful episodes of Dog Whisperer covered the red zone case of a 6-year-old pit bull named Emily. This case illustrated, among many other things, that when we stereotype a breed of dog by our worst expectations of its behavior, we often create what we fear most. You couldn't imagine a more appealing puppy than Emily. Even from birth, she was petite for her breed, sporting a milky white coat with cocoa brown spots. When teenaged Jessica saw that one of Emily's spots was shaped like a perfect heart, she knew that Emily was special. It's a charming feature like this that endears us to a dog and prompts us to bring it to live with us, often without really understanding the extent of our responsibility to that animal. Jessica fell in love with Emily at first sight and impulsively brought her home. Jessica lived with her father, Dave, who had let his daughter get away with everything while she was growing up. He didn't want her to have a dog. And when he learned that the dog she'd chosen was a pit bull, he was even more averse. He had always heard that pit bulls were dangerous, uncontrollable dogs. But Emily, as a puppy, was the cutest thing he'd ever seen. So, as usual, he caved in to his daughter's wishes. It turned out that just as Dave never gave Jessica any rules, boundaries, or limitations, so Jessica didn't give Emily any either. At the same time, Dave watched with dread as Emily grew up, unfortunately, regarding her with an undercurrent of fear. One day she's going to be dangerous, he believed, consciously or unconsciously. As much as he loved the dog, he couldn't keep these thoughts out of his mind. As I've tried to illustrate in this book, the thoughts we have about animals become energy. Energy they pick up. Our impressions of them become who they are. It's not magic mumbo-jumbo. Energy comes out in myriad physical ways. The way we pet a dog, the way we handle a dog, the scents and emotions we transmit to the dog. During her whole puppyhood, Emily was living with an owner who was preparing to be afraid of her. He tiptoed around her, worrying that she'd grow up to be a big, bad pit bull, and all the while letting her run roughshod over the house, bark wildly at other dogs on walks, and totally dominate him and his daughter in every activity, in every way. Emily was also raised in a household where she wasn't exposed to others of her kind. This happens to many dogs. Some dogs, mellow, medium, or low-energy, happy-go-lucky dogs, are not affected by this. They can be 5 years old when they go to their first dog park and act as if they've known the other dogs all their lives. But many dogs are not happy-go-lucky dogs. Many, especially shelter dogs, are like Emily. They are sensitive, reactive, and extremely receptive to their owner's energy. The first time Emily was taken for a walk, she reacted aggressively to dogs that approached her, and Jessica and Dave always pampered and comforted her after such displays of aggression. Emily therefore inferred that it was her job to protect her family. By the time I met Emily, she was 6 years old and a sweet dog with her human companions, provided they never asked her to do anything. With other dogs, however, she was as far into the red zone as she could get. If she so much as scented another dog nearby on a walk, she'd go crazy. She'd bark, struggle against the leash, and try to attack. She'd pull so hard on her leash she'd come close to choking herself, but was oblivious to the pain. A classic sign of a dog in the red zone. Red zone dogs will indeed hurt themselves in their frenzy to kill. Dave was afraid that Emily would hurt not only another dog, but also any person who got between her and that dog. So, worried about Emily's temperament, Dave and Jessica stopped walking her altogether. For years, they left her to run around their medium-sized backyard where her aggression and frustration continued to build. Dave and Jessica had created the very monster they had feared. A very dangerous pit bull. Emily's dog aggression was so severe that I brought her to the Dog Psychology Center for 6 weeks of intensive therapy I call boot camp. She was definitely in touch with that part of her mind that was pit bull. I needed her to be with the pack so she could reconnect with the deeper parts of her mind that were animal and dog. Being with others of their own kind is powerfully therapeutic for dogs. Although they readily accept us as members of a pack, we'll forever be speaking to them in a foreign language. Dogs speak one another's language instinctually. In order to achieve full balance, they need to be around other dogs with balanced energies. Emily needed to be around dogs in order to relearn how to be a dog. When she first arrived at the center and got a look at my pack of 40 dogs staring at her from behind the fence, her tough girl demeanor evaporated. It was like a canine version of scared straight. Would she fight, flee, avoid, or submit? The usually aggressive Emily actually froze. She was under so much stress, she vomited 3 times before she made it behind the gates. I walked her through the crowd, where she let other dogs smell her for the first time. She was terrified. But when I put her alone in a fenced-off area, she relaxed. She gave me calm submission so readily that I knew she would leave the center a different girl. During her 6 weeks at the center, I worked with Emily daily. I kept her isolated at first, letting her watch the pack interact with each other. Dogs learn a great deal from watching other dogs and picking up their energies. Then, after a vigorous run or rollerblading session to drain her energy, I began putting her out with the pack, first for an hour a day, then for two, then three, and so on. During her first weeks, I always supervised her when she was in the pack, so I could break up a fight in case one began. She instigated one small scuffle early on, after which I lay her on her side and asked her to submit to the other dog. After that, she started to get used to the routine. Whenever I worked with her, I'd exercise her first. A tired mind is more ready to submit. Emily was an extremely high-energy dog and had years of pent-up energy fueling her aggression. We did extra rollerblading and running on the treadmill. By the end of the second week, she was beginning to relax around the other members of the pack. Midway through Emily's program, I invited Dave and Jessica to come visit her. I wanted to observe what effect their presence had on her progress. I could tell they were tense by the way they walked through the pack. Then, sure enough, while Dave was walking her, Emily suddenly attacked Oliver, one of two Springer Spaniels in the pack. I broke the fight up in seconds, but it confirmed what I had been concerned about from the start. Dave's tentative energy, the way he tiptoed around Emily, and Jessica's extreme anxiety over Emily's aggressive tendencies sent Emily right back into the dominant state she had always experienced when she was around them. Emily would need more work and patience from me, and her owners would need some serious work, too. I had to communicate to them how much they were contributing to Emily's instability. It was hard for them to hear because they truly loved her, and their initial instinct was to feel guilty for the past. For Emily's sake, I asked them to let go of the past and try to live in the present, the only place where Emily was living. Their homework was to prepare for the calm, assertive leadership positions they'd have to take on once Emily came home to them. Before I brought Emily to the center, there had been a very real danger that she could attack and kill another dog. She was in a constant state of hyped-up tension. When I brought her home to Dave and Jessica 6 weeks later, they barely recognized the calm, relaxed pit bull walking alongside of me. The hardest part for them was not being able to greet her with an effusive welcome back and shower her with affection from the start. I tried to get them to see that by holding back their emotions, they were giving her the gift of a new, calmer way of being. Emily wasn't thinking, "Hey, I wonder why they're not all excited. I'm home." Remember, dogs sense when we are happy, and especially when we are happy with them. The kind of emotional, excited energy Jessica and Dave had been used to sharing with Emily needed to be tempered, because it had only created more excitement for her. And excitement in a high-energy dog creates excess energy that needs to be released. Once Emily was used to being home and was calm, submissive, then Dave and Jessica were welcome to share affection to their heart's content. I gave them as daily homework to walk Emily by the home of her old enemy, the Doberman, next door. It would take patience and a strict routine. They needed to get used to correcting Emily properly if she ever started going into aggression mode again. The good news about Emily is that not only is she doing well, but she has also come back to the center to stay while her owners are out of town. It has done my heart good to see her here again. She was welcomed back by everybody as an old, familiar member of the pack. too far gone. Though some trainers and behaviorists disagree with me, I believe there are very few dogs that can't be rehabilitated, even if they've reached the red zone. To me, the dogs in my pack are walking proof that if a dog's needs are being fulfilled every day, its natural instincts incline it toward balance. Still, of the thousands of dogs I've worked with, there were two cases that came to me where I couldn't in good conscience allow the dogs to go back into society. I'll never forget those dogs, or stop wishing I could have done more for them. Working with those dogs was a lesson to me that it is possible for an animal to be too far gone for me to help it. It also showed me the terrible, unforgivable damage human beings can inflict upon the animals that trust us to care for them. The first dog was Cedar, a 2-year-old female purebred pit bull. Cedar was not a fighting pit bull, but she had been terribly abused by whoever had raised her. There was a lot of whipping and physical cruelty, and her aggression had obviously been nurtured and encouraged. She had also been trained or conditioned by humans to attack humans. She didn't just go for the legs or arms. She went for the neck. She went in for the kill. This isn't natural. The pit bull breed was not bred to attack humans, period. Cats, goats, other dogs, yes. But it's in a pit bull's nature to run away from a human, or to attack only when crowded or cornered. Clearly, a human had redirected Cedar's aggression toward attacking people, and had done this to a point where Cedar wanted nothing to do with any other human being ever. Her previous owners obviously saw her as a weapon, not a living creature. Then, for whatever reason, they abandoned her. A kind man from a rescue organization found Cedar roaming around the street. Cedar became very fond of this man. Even dogs that are human aggressive have the need to form a pack, and will often bond closely with one person. However, if anyone else gets near the dog, watch out. It soon became clear that Cedar saw all other humans as enemies. She attacked anyone else who came around her. The man who'd rescued her meant well. But he did what everybody always does. He nurtured the aggression with affection and sympathy. He would say, "But she loves me. She doesn't do that to me." Unfortunately, she did attack everybody else. The shelter approached me and asked if I could rehabilitate Cedar. From the moment I reached into Cedar's crate, I could see the look in her eye as she growled and started staring at my neck. I managed to get a leash on her and worked with her for hours, every single day, over and over, to the point where both of us were exhausted. After a little over 2 weeks, I was able to get her to accomplish calm submission with me, but with no one else but me. If one of my assistants approached her, Cedar would start the attack behavior over again, aiming right for the neck. At that point, the shelter asked me for a progress report. I had to tell them that I didn't believe Cedar was safe to return to society. She was just too damaged and posed a real, life-threatening danger. Cedar is still alive today, but she's kept confined with the one man she trusts. No other human can even be in the same room with her. She was my first failure. In a lifetime of living and working with dogs, I'd never seen a case like this. Cedar truly opened my eyes to how deeply a dog can be damaged. The second dog I couldn't rehabilitate was a 5-year-old male Chow Golden Retriever mix I'll call Brutus. He had been rescued by a woman and had become unnaturally possessive toward her. After he attacked and tried to kill her husband, the woman came to me. I had Brutus for a long time, and for a while it seemed that he was doing well. But every once in a while, if I corrected him, he would wait until my back was turned and try to attack me. Unlike Cedar, who went for the jugular, Brutus would attack low, but he went at it full force. He wouldn't let go, he wouldn't surrender, and he was never predictable. When his rescuer returned, I told her that although he was calmer than when he arrived, I didn't feel that he was fully rehabilitated. I couldn't predict this dog's reactions, and after all the time I had had with him, I still wasn't comfortable with his progress. Despite my warnings, the woman still wanted to take him back. A week later, I called her to check up on him, and the woman raved about how much better he was doing. About a month after that, he attacked another man. Brutus will have to live out his life under close supervision at a no-kill shelter, and like Cedar, he was condemned to this life by humans who mistreated him. I would like to see sanctuaries created for any dogs who can't achieve rehabilitation and who can't safely be around humans. In my wildest dreams, I imagine golf courses being turned into dog sanctuaries with professionally trained people to care for the dogs and to study them as well. These damaged dogs can definitely teach us a lot. They can teach us about the abuses that create killer dogs. They can show us how detrimental it is for them to live unstable lives. And they can help us differentiate between unstable dogs that can't let go and dogs that have the ability to become balanced. We can begin to learn what signs to look for in a dog that can't be turned around. In my opinion, we shouldn't be putting them down. These dogs are dying from what we humans have done to them. I think we should be creative enough to find a way in which they can live out the rest of their lives as comfortably as possible. A dog is not a weapon. In this modern world, everybody's concerned about crime and how it can affect their families. For thousands of years, humans have been using dogs as guards and as weapons, both against animals and against other humans. Today, it seems we're mostly afraid of one another. Dogs, especially the powerful breeds, can indeed make good guards for your family. They certainly serve as a powerful deterrent. Statistics show that 75% of dog owners want their dogs to play a protective role in their households. But when we insist that a dog be both our loyal, loving companion and a weapon for our protection, we may be asking too much. Some of the red zone dogs I've described were chained and confined to small areas as guard dogs, and even if they underwent no other form of abuse, the frustration that built up in them was potentially lethal for any intruder, including a mailman, a relative, or an innocent child who just happened to wander by. If your dog attacks someone, you can be sued for everything you own. And as in the Diane Whipple case, you can even be charged with a crime and go to prison. And think of your dog's welfare. Most dogs that attack people are put down by law enforcement or animal control. These agencies don't want to take a risk as far as the general public's safety or public opinion is concerned. If you are using your dog as a defensive weapon, this could very well happen to you. Although most of my work is now in dog rehabilitation, I have been and still am involved in the training of guard dogs, police dogs, and attack dogs. There is an art to training these animals, and doing it responsibly takes a professional. If you decide you want a powerful breed dog to serve as protection for your house, you need to go about doing it the right way. You need experienced guidance and must learn to share the strongest form of calm, assertive leadership with your dog. However, you should first weigh carefully all the pros and cons of having your dog lead a double life, of being both guardian and friend. Our responsibility. As dog owners, we have a responsibility both to our dogs and to our fellow humans to manage our dog's behavior. If we have a dog who hasn't been properly socialized or rehabilitated and is in any way dangerous to our neighbors or their dogs, then we are behaving recklessly by letting that dog out in society. There are some dog behaviorists and veterinarians who believe that positive reinforcement and approval techniques alone are appropriate for any dog, anytime, in any situation. In my opinion, if a dog's behavior can be conditioned using treats and positive reinforcement, that's an ideal situation. It's always best for humans to approach dog behavior and training with a positive and compassionate outlook, and it's never, ever right to punish a dog out of anger. Dogs and all animals must always be treated humanely. But we must also remember that red zone dogs will often escalate in their aggression until they kill or maim either another dog or, in a worst-case scenario, a human being. A red zone dog is dangerously out of balance, and no amount of loving or praise or cookies will stop him from doing serious harm. If you are the owner of a powerful breed of dog, you can do nothing to control the energy of the people around you. You can't expect someone not to be fearful of your dog, even if your dog has never hurt a flea. The only thing you can control is your dog, and you owe it to the other people and animals around you to do so. Red zone dogs need to know we're in control. That doesn't mean we should be aggressive with them. Punishing a dog does not cure aggression. Usually, if a dog is in the red zone, it exacerbates it. But as that dog's caretaker, we must be strong and assertive, and we must consistently correct unwanted and dangerous behavior. Dogs have to know our power and that we are the pack leaders. As much of this is accomplished through our mindset as it is our physical discipline. That said, many aggressive dogs can only be helped by qualified experts who are advanced and experienced in handling dangerous red zone cases. If you have the slightest doubt about your ability to handle your dog, or if you think the dog could pose a threat to you or your family's safety, you owe it to yourself and your dog to find an accomplished expert whose techniques and philosophy you can live with. Finally, it's my personal opinion that no red zone dog should lose its life unless every possible avenue of rehabilitation or placement for that dog has been exhausted. There are far too few no-kill shelters in the world, and those that exist are always filled to the brim and hurting for money. The dedicated people running these centers, however, share my conviction that it is wrong to commit an animal to a death sentence when it had no moral awareness or intellectual control over what it was doing. We should not be condemning dogs to death for having become the monsters their human owners created, and that the dogs were never born to be. Chapter 7. Caesar's Fulfillment Formula for a Balanced and Healthy Dog. This book isn't a how-to manual. As I mentioned in the introduction, I'm not here to teach you how to get your dog to recognize voice commands or hand signals. I'm not here to teach you how to properly make your dog heel or do tricks. There are plenty of guides and books related to dog training, and many qualified specialists out there who can do that. But although my primary mission is simply to help you understand your dog's psychology better, I also have some practical advice to offer you. This advice applies to all dogs, no matter the breed, no matter the age or size, no matter the temperament, or whether the dog is dominant or submissive. This is my 3-part formula for fulfilling your dog's life. Be reminded, this isn't a one-time fix for a troubled dog. Dogs aren't appliances. You can't simply send them out to be repaired once and that's it. If you expect this formula to work, you have to practice it every day of your dog's life. The formula is simple. In order to have a balanced dog, you must provide 3 things. Exercise, discipline, affection. In that order. Why is the order important? Because it's the natural order of your dog's inborn needs. The problem in the United States is that most dogs receive only part of the formula from their owners. Affection, affection, affection. Some people do better, giving their dogs half affection, half exercise. Others practice all three, but put affection first. As I've stressed again and again in this book, that is a recipe for an unbalanced dog. Yes, our dogs crave our affection, but they need exercise and leadership first, especially exercise, as you'll soon see. 1. Exercise. This is the first part of your dog's formula for happiness, and it is absolutely the one thing you cannot skip. Ironically, it's the first thing most owners in the United States fail at doing. Perhaps it's because Americans in general seem to have problems with getting enough exercise for themselves and don't recognize that all animals, even humans, have an inborn need to be active. Just getting out and being physical, moving our bodies, seems to have taken a back seat to everything else in our society these days. Our modern lives are so busy that it seems overwhelming to have to add in daily walks with our dogs on top of everything else. But if you are going to take on the responsibility of living with a dog, this is the contract you sign. You need to walk with your dog every day, preferably at least twice a day, and for a minimum of 30 minutes at a time. Walking with your dog is a primal activity. It is hardwired into her brain to migrate with her pack. Dogs don't simply enjoy walks because they get to pee and poop and get some fresh air, although shockingly, this seems to be the perception of many owners. To some dog owners, walking the dog means letting her out in the yard to do her business, then letting her back in the house. This is torture for a dog. Every cell in your dog's body is crying out for a walk. In nature, dogs will spend up to 12 hours migrating for food. Wolves, dogs' living ancestors, have been known to range over hundreds of miles and hunt for 10 hours in their natural habitat. Dogs naturally have different energy levels, and some dogs need to walk more often than others. Some breeds have genes that tell them to walk longer or faster or farther, but all dogs walk. All animals travel. Fish need to swim, birds need to fly, and dogs need to walk. Walking with your dog is the single most powerful tool I can offer you to help you connect with all the aspects of your dog's mind. Animal, dog, breed, and name. All at the same time. By mastering the walk, you have the ability to truly bond with your dog as her pack leader. The walk is the foundation of your relationship. It is also where a dog learns to be a dog. She learns about her environment, about the other animals and humans in it, about dangers such as cars, and things to be avoided such as bikes and skateboards. She gets to pee on trees, and really get to know her territory. Animals need to connect with the world and be out in it. It's not natural for them to spend all their time indoors or behind walls. Another part of the power broker paradox that I spoke of, the tendency for very powerful people to have very messed up dogs, is that these people often have huge, luxurious homes with enormous backyards. They think letting their dog roam in their estate's backyard is enough exercise for her. Never think you can substitute having a big backyard for going on a primal walk with your dog. Sure, it could be several acres of property, but to your dog, it's just a very big kennel behind walls. Also, allowing your dog simply to roam around all day by herself isn't providing her with the structure she gets when she migrates with her pack leader. A structured, regular walking schedule is vital, especially for dogs with behavior problems and issues. Master the walk. Every once in a while, after I've visited new clients and worked with their dogs, the clients will say to me, "We paid $350 for this consultation, and all you're going to tell us is to walk our dog more?" In some cases, yes, it is that simple. However, it's all about what I call mastering the walk. There is one right way to walk with your dog, and a million wrong ways to do it. I'd say that 90% of Americans do it the wrong way. Think I'm exaggerating? Here's an exercise for you. Go to a big city park, such as Central Park in New York or Griffith Park in Los Angeles, and watch all the dog owners walking their pets. Observe 10 of them. Count how many of them have their dogs out in front of them, on a long leash or a flexi leash. Note how many of them are being pulled by their dogs. Add up the numbers of walkers who are standing by, waiting patiently while their dogs sniff the ground, the trees, everything around them, completely oblivious to their owner's presence. None of these dog owners has correctly mastered the walk. Now, out of the 10 dog and owner groupings you saw, how many had their dogs obediently walking next to them or behind them? Not many? Now check out the other side of the tracks, the part of town where the homeless live. See any difference in the body language of both the person and the dog? Ironically, the homeless seem to have the art of walking with a dog down pat. They aren't being dragged behind by their dogs. Their dogs don't set the agenda of where they're going or what they're going to do. Why? Number one, because they travel together for so many miles a day, every day. And second, because the dogs see the homeless owners as their pack leaders. The homeless owners aren't pampering their dogs, giving them treats or petting them all day, although the dogs can sense that their homeless owners are happy about having them around. The owners are providing leadership, someone to follow who will eventually lead the dogs to food and water and a place to rest. Their lives are simple but structured. A proper walk should be just that, simple but structured. The leash. First of all, I usually recommend a very simple, short leash. The leashes that I use are nothing more than 15-cent cords of nylon that I loop into collars myself. Of course, if you are concerned about fashion, you don't have to go as down and dirty as I do. But I recommend, especially for problem dogs, that you fasten the collar over the top part of the dog's head, not around her neck. Most collars rest on the strongest part of a dog's neck, which allows her to have full control over her head, and sometimes, if she's a strong breed dog, full control over you, too. If you want to see an example of how my style of leash looks, take a look at an American Kennel Club dog show. This is how handlers of show dogs leash their animals. You'll see a handler and dog running around the ring together, with the handler lightly holding the leash and using it to gently lift the dog's head up. Dogs in dog shows look so proud of themselves with their heads up, and considering the relationship between energy and body language, that's probably how they feel. No, they're not proud of their haircut or their blue ribbon. They don't care about those things. In the dog world, a head held high is positive body language, a sign of healthy self-esteem. By holding the leash in this position, you also have maximum control over your dog. She can go only where you want her to go. Many people in the United States seem to like flexi leashes because they believe their dog needs freedom during a walk. There will be a time to share freedom later in the walk, but it will be the kind of freedom that you control. I'm not a fan of flexi leashes, except for the mellowest, most happy-go-lucky dogs. Still, ultimately the choice of leash is up to you. Whatever you choose, don't let your dog's excitement over seeing you get the leash and put it on her control the whole experience. I had one client from Dog Whisperer, Liz, whose Dalmatian Lola would go wild and jump all over her the moment Liz took the flexi leash off the coat rack. Then Lola would charge out the door, pulling the flexi leash to its maximum length, and sometimes right out of Liz's hands. Needless to say, this is entirely the wrong way to leave the house with your dog. Leaving the house. Yes, believe it or not, there is a right way and a wrong way of going out the door. First of all, never let your dog control the activity, the way Liz did with Lola. Your leadership must start before the walk. Don't allow your dog to wear the leash until she is in a calm, submissive state. Once your dog is calm, put the leash on and proceed toward the door. Don't let your dog get overexcited again while you're standing at the door or in the doorway. Even if you have to wait, once again make sure your dog is in a calm, submissive state. Then open the door. You go out the door first. This really does matter. By going out the door first, you are saying to your dog, "I am the pack leader, inside and outside of the home." When you walk your dog, make sure she is beside you or behind you. When someone's dog is way out in front of them or pulling them, the dog is walking the human. The dog is leading the pack. You're probably used to your dog wanting to sniff every bush, tree, plant, and patch of grass she sees. That's normal for a dog. But when you are in migrating mode, the dog should not stop until you tell her to stop. Imagine if a wolf pack needed to migrate 10 miles and every dog was doing its own thing, sniffing trees and grass instead of moving forward. The pack would never get to the food. The walk is first to bond the two of you and show your leadership, second for exercise, and third for your dog to explore. You should hold the leash firmly, but with a relaxed arm, as if you were carrying a briefcase. And most important, remember your calm, assertive energy. Think Oprah. Think Cleopatra. Think John Wayne. Think about an experience where you felt strong and in control. Straighten your posture. Lift your shoulders high and stick your chest forward. Do whatever it takes to really own that calm, assertive energy and project it through the leash and to your dog, who picks up on every signal you send. Many of my clients have been amazed at how simply increasing their calm, assertive energy and projecting it on a walk has calmed their dogs down. It's not magic. It's nature at work. Dogs naturally want to follow a calm, assertive leader. Once you claim that role, they naturally fall in line. Now that you've established a rhythm, and you've been walking uninterrupted for a few minutes, now is the time to let your dog go ahead of you. A little bit. Release the tension on your leash and let your dog pee, sniff the grass, whatever she wants to do. Remember, she's doing it when you say so. That's the key. Ironically, when you give a dog permission to do this, she'll probably spend less time on it than if she were allowed to do it on her own from the beginning. When I walk my pack of 40 to 50 dogs off leash in the mountains, we'll go for 30, 40 minutes with them behind me. And then the pack is allowed to be in front of me for 5 minutes. That's the kind of freedom your dogs need. But with rules, boundaries, and limitations. I allow them to go only 30, 40 feet away from me. If they cross the line, a quick sound from me will remind them to fall back. Personally, my favorite exercise to do with my pack, one that really gets their energy drained, is to go rollerblading with them. I put on my inline skates and skate with as many as 10 dogs at a time down the streets of South Los Angeles, on leash, of course. Sometimes I get funny looks. People can't believe their eyes. But the dogs love this. Sometimes I pull them. Sometimes they pull me. But I am always in charge. By the end of a 3-hour session, everybody's tired and more than happy to be calm submissive for the rest of the day. Treadmills. If you're not able to walk your dog as much as her level of energy requires, then a treadmill is a viable option. The treadmill should not be the only walking your dog does. Remember, she needs to walk with you. But it's a great way to give added stress relief to a dog that has a lot of energy to burn. It becomes both a physical and a psychological challenge for her. Dogs are like men in the human world. We both can concentrate on only one thing at a time. And when a dog's on a treadmill, she's going to have to concentrate. She's going to get in the zone. Many of my clients are skeptical about putting a dog on a treadmill. They think the dog will hurt herself, especially if she's on a leash. Proper supervision is required at first, but any dog has the ability to do this. Dogs using treadmills are nothing new. This isn't something I invented. Back in 1576, Dr. Johannes Caius of Cambridge University described a mongrel breed of dog he called a turnspit. These dogs were specifically trained to walk on treadmills that mechanically turned the spits on which people roasted their meat. This breed of dog is now extinct, since the popularity of the oven took off, no doubt. But if dogs could be trained to walk on the manual treadmills of the 15th and 16th centuries, how much more difficult could it be for them to be trained to walk on the electric ones of the 21st century? One of my clients was the CEO of a $60 billion company and a household name. His dog, a powerful male German shepherd, was out of control, attacking and biting people. But the owner was in total denial about it. It was his wife who called me in. I worked with her husband for several hours and could see that he was completely defensive. It wasn't his fault. It was his wife and kids' fault. He was a busy guy. He didn't have time to walk the dog. I said, "Well, since you insist you can't walk your dog, can you put him on a treadmill?" And he said, "No, no way. This dog would never in a million years go on a treadmill." I just stayed quiet. When he had finished, I asked him, "Are you ready to see him on the treadmill?" He started getting angry with me. "I'm telling you, this dog will never, ever be on a treadmill." It took me 5 seconds to put that dog on the treadmill, and he took to it right away. The dog was right at home in a matter of seconds. My client was speechless. He's not the kind of guy many people prove wrong or dare to tell he's wrong. But I was there for the good of the dog, not his owner's ego. I'm afraid this powerful man may not put in the energy to follow through on my advice until he's slapped with a lawsuit. Unfortunately, that's the only thing that will get some of my clients to take their dog's behavior seriously. I recommend that you first hire a professional to teach you the safety basics about putting a dog on a treadmill. For a dog, the first 2 weeks on a treadmill are a mental challenge because the floor is moving and the dog's instinct tells her to run away when the floor is moving. After 2 weeks, you'll see your dog scratching at the treadmill, begging you to turn it on. Dogs become addicted to it. A healthy kind of addiction. If you start at a very low speed and you supervise your dog closely until you're sure she's completely comfortable, you should be able to put her on the treadmill and go about your business as long as you're not too far away. Never leave her there too long without checking on her, of course. But treadmill walking at a reasonable speed, while not a substitute for a walk outdoors, can be a safe and healthy contribution to your active dog's exercise regimen. It's especially important for powerful breed dogs that need extra workouts to help control their dominance or aggression. Doggy backpacks. Another technique I use for high-energy dogs that need more of a workout is a doggy backpack. Adding weight to a dog during her walk, or even during her treadmill walk, makes her work harder. It also gives her something to focus on, a job to do. Dogs love having jobs. And as I've already mentioned, they can't do more than one thing at a time. If they're focused on walking and carrying, they are much less likely to be thinking about chasing after every cat that walks by or yelping at bicyclists. Have you ever watched a Boy Scout troop on a hike? No matter how hyperactive they may be back at camp, they are always calm and submissive when they're hiking with backpacks on. Wearing a backpack almost always calms a dog down. It's like Prozac without the side effects. The backpacks are made in various sizes and styles. Look up dog backpack on the internet to find one that's right for your pet. The ballast you put inside the pack should weigh between 10% and 20% of your dog's body weight, depending on her energy level and needs. Backpacks have helped work miracles in many of the dogs I've rehabilitated. Coach, an aggressive and overly protective boxer, exhibited behavior that was so out of control that he was scheduled to be put to sleep the very day I came to work with him. Although he had been to obedience classes, his family had not been walking him at all. With regular walks and new rules, boundaries, and limitations from the entire family, Coach is so well behaved now that he walks to school with his 8-year-old owner and carries the boy's books in his doggy backpack. There's nothing more therapeutic for a dog than giving him a job to do, and carrying a backpack is a job. Coach is a dog who went from death row to being a companion dog worthy of the Little Rascals in a matter of weeks. Dog walkers. Finally, if you absolutely cannot walk your dog, if you are injured or ill or incapacitated in some way, I suggest you hire a professional dog walker. It's not an ideal situation for forming that pack leader, pack follower bond that you want with your dog, but it does help her get used to having a human leader. Some committed dog owners I know walk their dogs in the mornings and evenings and hire a walker to make sure their dog is properly exercised at noon. Not everyone can afford such a luxury, but for those who can, I'll bet it's a lot less expensive than the legal fees you'd be paying if your under-exercised dog's behavior problem got you into a lawsuit. You should check out the references of any dog walker, of course, and make sure to observe him when he's out for a walk. Is he in control of the dogs? Are they dragging him around? Or are they showing him respect? Make sure you're comfortable with anyone you're leaving your pet with. Your dog can't complain to you when you bring her home, so you'll have to rely on your own judgment. Dogs need jobs. From the beginning of creation, dogs were made to have jobs. In the wild, the pack functions like a well-oiled hunting machine. And when we first domesticated dogs, we specifically bred them to take advantage of their innate working abilities. We started creating the breeds based on how we thought we could best use them for our own needs. We like the way one dog jumps over obstacles. We like the way another dog digs in the ground. We like the way this dog retrieves, and that one herds sheep. 95% of dog breeds around the world today were originally working breeds. No more than 5% of today's dogs were bred to be lap dogs. Dogs, both wild and domestic, were born to work. But in modern-day America, we don't always have legitimate work for our dogs with special talents. Therefore, the walk is the most important job you can give a dog. Walking with you, the owner, is both a physical and a mental activity for your dog. After she has accomplished this primal form of exercise, then it's fine to do the other things you enjoy doing together. Playing fetch, swimming in the pool, and doing tricks, the more exciting kinds of activities. Just as you wouldn't leave your kids at Chuck E. Cheese's all day, you also set a time limit for these more frenetic activities with your dog. But, like the big backyard, these games are not substitutes for the walk. You cannot skip the walk. After the walk, your dog will naturally go into the deepest form of resting mode. Humans would call it meditation mode. When she is in this mode, you can leave the house and go on with your day, secure in the knowledge that your dog knows you're the pack leader, and that all that boundless energy inside her is being channeled properly and constructively. Discipline. When it comes to dog behavior, the word discipline has gotten a very bad rap lately. The people who refuse even to allow that word to pass their lips usually define discipline as punishment. To me, the word has a different meaning altogether. Of course, it means rules, boundaries, and limitations, but it also has a much more profound meaning for me, with regard to my dogs and also to my own life. Discipline makes you a better person, makes you fit, makes you healthy, and helps you have a healthy relationship because you are disciplined to do what is best for the relationship. This doesn't mean I discipline my wife by telling her when she has done something wrong. In my household, it would probably be the other way around anyway. Discipline in our relationship means I'm part of a couple, part of a structure that tells me what my boundaries are. Because I'm disciplined, I'm going to live up to my commitment. When I promise my wife I'll do something, I'm going to do it. When she promises me she'll do something, she's going to do it. Every single day. To me, discipline is a word that helps me to stay on target, to reach my goals and dreams. It's a word that allows me to stay balanced, to be a respectful human being, an honest human being, someone who wants the best for himself and for everything around him, from trees to animals to human beings. Without discipline, you can't really be a good role model. If you're not a disciplined person, you become negative energy or negative source. Running my dog psychology center, I have to be disciplined. I have to be disciplined with planning each day. I have to keep to a schedule. I have to make sure every day that the dogs have water, that they have food, that they have exercise. I have to watch their health closely and take them to the veterinarian if they get sick. I have to clean up after them. If I were not disciplined about these things, not only would my business fail, but my precious dogs could become ill and even die. Discipline, to me, is serious business. Mother Nature responds to discipline. Discipline, rules, boundaries, and limitations exists in every species on the planet. Bees are disciplined. Ants are disciplined. Birds are disciplined. Dolphins are very disciplined. If you've ever seen dolphins hunting a school of anchovies, you've seen how orderly they are in working together to herd their prey. Wolves are disciplined not only when they hunt, but also when they travel, when they play, and when they eat. They don't question discipline. Nature doesn't view discipline as a negative thing. Discipline is DNA. Discipline is survival. Think about how discipline figures in your life. If you're Lance Armstrong, discipline means keeping in shape, training, eating the right foods, and riding for so many miles a week. If you work at Starbucks, discipline means getting to the job on time, memorizing all the endless names of coffee drinks, knowing how much foam to put in a cappuccino and a latte, and knowing how to be polite even when there's a long line of impatient customers. That's discipline. To succeed at anything, you must practice discipline. If you're taking a Tai Bo class with Billy Blanks, you'd better be disciplined when he tells you to lift your leg. And he's not being mean about it. He simply knows you can't accomplish what you went there to accomplish without practicing discipline. That's how I share discipline when it comes to dogs. It's my job to tell them when to wake up, when to eat, and how to interact with one another. I set rules, boundaries, and limitations about where to go and at what pace, when to rest, when to pee, whom to chase, whom not to chase, where to dig a hole, where to roll over. All that is part of discipline. To me, discipline is not punishment. It's the rules, boundaries, and limitations that exist for the good of the dogs and for my relationship with them. Corrections. In nature, dogs correct one another all the time. Mothers correct their pups constantly.